after the blue light comes on, I'd like to open the House Committee on Education for May 8th, 2015. We're going to go a little bit out of order today, but before we do that, I'd like to welcome the kids from Horizons, from Heritage School. And of course, they're sitting in the front row. Very good. I like that. Well, most of you are. Anyway, I hope you enjoy our little exercise in democracy here today, but welcome. Okay, the first thing we're going to open up with is Senate Bill 667A. Richard, if you could read it.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 667A extends the sunset related to grants distributed to small school districts with one or more small high schools. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay. And so, Justin Martin. Martin, please.
Would you like that? It's not.
Okay, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. On behalf of the Oregon Small Schools Association, I will be very brief because I know you've got a full agenda, and I know you've got my testimony as well, and my little mini one-pager here is so small I don't know if I can read it even with my own glasses.
Jeez.
So, with that, we are here in full support of Senate Bill 667A. We were able to get it over from the Senate unanimously. It is something that we have continuously done over the past several years. Originally, the small high school grant was appropriated in 2001. And then we came back and did that again in 2003. We then came back to the legislature again and did it in 2007. And then in 2012. And then another extension in 2013. So here we are again in 2015 asking for those funds. And I think the committee knows it costs more per student in our little rural communities throughout the state. This money is extremely important to us. And I guess I will follow up with one bullet from the testimony you have in front of you from Tim Sweeney, superintendent of Coquille, that really sums up the value of the small high school grant. He says, "I cannot begin to express how critical these little pools of money are for small schools. Our lifeblood, and they sustain so many important education opportunities in rural Oregon." So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would ask for your support of Senate Bill 667. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Springer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And obviously, I've supported this bill every time it comes forward. It makes sense. Why do we have a sunset on it? Why do we do this each time?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, that's a very good question. And I think some of the discussions have centered around school funding. We need to look at school funding. We need to look how everybody fits into the overall picture. And we appreciate that. And by the same token, we're always willing and available to have those conversations, whether that's consolidation, whether that's incentives for other incentives for small schools. But this is beginning to be somewhat of a tiring exercise in continuing to come in front of the legislature.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And we had that task force looking at school funding. There wasn't an adjustment suggested on this piece. Actually ended up with pretty much what we're doing is the best we can come up with. So I would certainly advocate for an amendment that would remove the sunset so we not spend the resources, the time, and the energy every session having this conversation.
This discussion has taken place before, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Springer, yes. We started the bill with a permanent deletion of that sunset. It ended up 5 years coming out of the Senate. Again, it's very important for our districts to be able to have certainty at the beginning of their budget cycle so they know what they can and cannot offer to those students in those rural areas. So thank you for those thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions?
I'm sorry. I haven't been here. I haven't heard it multiple times. So just real quick, is it so we're talking about students get their regular formula amounts plus whatever the grant amount is, and then what size are the schools that we're talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Reardon, yes, this is a grant that our school districts apply for, and give you a sense of how small our schools are. Okay. Let me try to read from my miniature one-pager with my newfound 45-year-old glasses. A K-12 school district would be membership of 1,650 ADM or less, which would equate to a high school grade through 9 ADM of less than 350 students, a 10 through 12 with about 267 students. So we're talking very, very small areas.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we looking at any more consolidations? Because this obviously came through when we were looking at a lot of consolidations and people wanted to have a reassessment of whether this was working or not and that and whether we've had some changes. But I don't anticipate we're going to see any schools close or be consolidated in the near future, or am I missing something here?
Madam Chair and Representative Frederick, in the few short years that I've represented the Small Schools Association, we have had those conversations. We continue to have those conversations. And again, we're always willing to be at the table to talk about some of those efforts. But again, we haven't seen that. And I think that's why we continually end up here asking to continually move this sunset forward. So.
Okay. Well, and just a kind of a comment, I represented a very small high school, Wasco County Union High School at the time, was not merged with Maupin Elementary School. And I think people don't realize how expensive it is to have a high school, because you have to have a licensed science teacher, a licensed math teacher, a licensed English teacher, a licensed social studies teacher, a licensed PE teacher, all of this, and sometimes the kids only 250 kids in the school. So I kind of agree with Representative Springer about maybe seeing if we can, just get rid of the sunset period and have it permanent, but maybe this is not quite the time to do it. So we'll take your lead on that. But it's a good program. It's one that's very, very necessary in rural Oregon, and sometimes not so rural. There's some very small school districts. So any other comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Martin was the only one signed up. Anyone else want to speak on Senate Bill 667A? Okay. Seeing none, I close the public hearing on House Bill 667 and is he here? And open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 83A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 83A establishes supervised clinical practice experience requirements for applicants for an initial teaching license. It first applies to the 2020-21 school year, directs the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to convene a work group to assist with the implementation of those requirements, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, thank you. So we have two people, Mary Cadiz and Kelsey Dale. Or Docke, or...
It's Dale.
Thank you. Is there anyone else?
No, that's it.
Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you very much.
Chair Doherty, Vice Chair Frederick, and Vice Chair Springer. I'm Mary Cadiz. I'm the Director of Teach Oregon, a chalkboard project initiative working with school districts and university teacher preparation programs in a collaborative effort to improve teacher preparation in Oregon. Three of the Teach Oregon projects are funded by chalkboard, and two are funded through the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning through ODE. We have partnerships with 13 school districts and 7 universities in Oregon. These folks are involved in these partnerships and are completing their second year of implementation. I'm here today to present you with an overview of Senate Bill 83. Senate Bill 83 is based on the work of the Teach Oregon pilots, along with the feedback and information provided to us through several sources, including, of course, cooperating teachers. In 2013, the Secretary of State's audit indicated that 50% of school administrators surveyed felt that the teachers they were hiring were not adequately prepared. In 2013, DHM Research, hired by Chalkboard, conducted a statewide survey of K-12 educators, and 92% of those respondents indicated that they supported purposeful placement of student teachers with high-quality cooperating teachers. In 2014, the Distinguished Educator Council, which is a group of 14 educators that advise Chalkboard, and these are teachers who come from all over the state and who've been recognized for their work in teaching, cited poor experiences as former cooperating teachers, indicating to Chalkboard that there was no training for the role, no intentional selection for placement, and minimal interaction with university supervisors, and few, if any, incentives for the cooperating teacher. So this means, then, we have a problem to address, and this is lack of coordination between districts and universities, a lack of selection criteria for cooperating teachers, which results in student teachers, or teacher candidates, as we're referring to them now, not being placed always with competent and accomplished cooperating teachers engaging in best practices. Teacher candidates are often placed with whomever raises their hands. Teacher candidates placed with teachers sometimes that are even on plans of assistance themselves. However, even placing teachers candidates with successful teachers doesn't ensure success, because someone who may be really effective at working with fifth graders may or may not be great at teaching an adult learner. Another problem is that there's minimal incentives for cooperating teachers to work over and above their contractual day, and working with a teacher candidate requires a lot of time. But the most important thing is the lack of training and information for the cooperating teacher. The outcome of all this is that often we're shortchanging our teacher candidates, our student teachers, for meaningful clinical practice experience. And we find that cooperating teachers are reluctant to take the role of working with teacher candidates in their classrooms. However, since we've implemented Teach Oregon, we've seen a reversal. In one Teach Oregon district, for example, the retention rate of cooperating teachers over the last two-year period when conditions were improved has gone from 54% to 92%. Overwhelmingly, teacher candidates tell us that their time in the classroom with students, their clinical practice experience, is the highlight and key element of their training to be a teacher. Thus, we must take steps to make sure this clinical experience is as effective as possible. Senate Bill 83 would require the convening of a work group over the next biennium, facilitated by TSPC with representatives from the association, active cooperating teachers, universities, both public and private, and nonprofits that are engaged in reform efforts. This work group would develop standards and guidelines as needed, recommend any needed legislative changes, identify funding sources, and develop the plan for training and preparing cooperating teachers for their work with teacher candidates. The Teach Oregon projects, already in probably the first 18 to 20 months, has trained 370 cooperating teachers in co-teaching and other advanced support strategies. And we believe much of the work that's being done in Teach Oregon can be leveraged by this work group. This bill would require our teacher preparation programs to place teacher candidates with a trained cooperating teacher by 2021. With the proposed timelines in the bill, there would be potentially 1,500 trained cooperating teachers by 2020-2021, and then a resupply of 100 cooperating teachers trained each subsequent year. I would like to introduce to you Kelsey Dake, who's a clinical teacher in the Salem-Keizer School District, and which means she's a cooperating teacher working with teacher candidates. You also have testimony from Cassandra Thonstead, who's a cooperating teacher in the Newburgh District. She's an advanced math teacher at Newburgh High School and had to give an AP exam today, and so we didn't want her to miss that. But you have her written testimony in your packet. I believe you also have a letter from Laura Nordquist, who is the assistant superintendent in the Bend Lapine School District, about the value of the training of cooperating teachers in Teach Oregon. So I'm going to introduce now to you Kelsey Dake.
Chair Doherty and members of the House Education Committee, I am Kelsey Dake. I'm currently a teacher at Cesar Chavez Elementary School in the Salem-Keizer School District, and I work closely with our university partners, Western Oregon University and Corbin University, in preparing teacher candidates for their role as classroom teachers as part of the Teach Oregon Project. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 83, Training for Cooperating Teachers. I would like to start by telling you about my experience working with a student teacher before the Teach Oregon Project was put in place and created a partnership between our school and our local universities. My first student teacher had a difficult time making it through her program. It was not all that different from my experience as a student teacher just 3 years prior. My student teacher was frustrated. She was overwhelmed with the expectations that are placed upon teachers. She found herself with lots of unanswered questions, and I had a hard time answering those questions. I was frustrated too. I felt like I wanted to support this person, but I didn't really know how. After that experience, I was lucky enough to get trained as a mentor teacher through the Clinical Teaching Academy. This training has taught me so many skills in working with student teachers, or now called teacher candidates. I've learned co-teaching strategies so I can model and support specific strategies in my classroom with my teacher candidates. I've been taught how to ask guiding questions, how to give constructive feedback, and be a much more involved mentor teacher than what the traditional student teaching experience ever allowed. Another major difference that I've experienced between the traditional model and the new clinical teaching model is the level of university support and involvement. In my own experience and with my first student teacher, the role of the university was minimal and it was disconnected with what was happening in the classroom. Now with the new model, the universities play a collaborative role with me and my teacher candidates. They are aligning their classes with our professional development. They have aligned their rubrics with our evaluation system. The university supervisors are in my classroom once or twice a week, all helping to support this developing new teacher by giving feedback and having observations. I'm here today speaking to you because I believe in this program. I've seen the difference between the old model and this new one. And to me, this level of collaboration and support is the right way to work with developing teachers. I think back to my own experience and how I made it through, but how it wasn't very easy for me. And I think about my first student teacher often, and I wonder what she's doing because she didn't successfully complete her program. I'm sorry for this, and I wish that I could have supported her. In the past 2 years, including this school year, I've worked with 5 teacher candidates. All 3 that I worked with last year have been hired in our school district and are now first-year teachers. When I see them now, I feel so proud of this work that we do, and I know that although their first year is challenging, that they have been set up for success. Not only is this a program that sets up teacher candidates for success, but it's a program that's affected me truly as well. I've been trained in how to teach children, and now I'm trained in how to teach adults. And this has been an incredible leadership opportunity for me, and it's really satisfying work. And you should see how this affects the students in my classroom as well. I have 30 second graders this year, and I can't explain how incredibly helpful it is to have another teacher in the classroom. Mm-hmm. With 2 teachers, we can differentiate instruction so much easier to create an environment that accommodates many levels of learning. And also, I think that the students benefit from seeing their teachers as lifelong learners. This work is incredibly important and beneficial to everyone who's involved. However, it takes a lot of extra time and hard work for mentor teachers. It is so nice to be acknowledged and compensated for this work. If all teachers in the state of Oregon became teacher candidates, supported by this collaboration between their mentor teachers and universities, I think this would be a huge step forward for our system of education. Thank you for your time today and letting me share my experiences in preparing new teachers for tomorrow's future. I hope you will support Senate Bill 83, Training for Cooperating Teachers.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any questions of this panel?
I had one.
Yeah, Representative McLean.
Your first name?
My first name is Kelsey.
Kelsey. You indicated that you'd worked with 3, you're going to call them teacher candidates now.
Mm-hmm.
So you worked with 3 in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 year. Because there used to be a rule when we were dealing with student teachers that we wouldn't be able to do more than 1 a year, because not only is it, I mean, you have to have training to be able to do that, but you also have to keep your own, you know, teaching skills
mm-hmm.
honed, And besides that, having, you know, a number of folks working with the same class has always been, you know, you want some consistency, too. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering if that is just your experience or if that's the experience of everyone that's being trained to be this cooperative teacher.
Thank you, Representative McLean. Last year, I was placed with what's called a dyad. Mm-hmm. And so there were two teacher candidates placed in my classroom. And they came the week before school started in August mm-hmm. and worked with me all the way through spring break. And so the three of us worked together, and I was able to train them both. Mm-hmm. And that was not that is not the most common method. However, it's something that has been tried and tested, and it has been really incredibly successful mm-hmm. Because the teacher candidates can also find support in each other. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, the benefits of the students. So the schedule with Western Oregon University's teacher candidates, they are placed in a classroom from the beginning of the school year through spring break mm-hmm. in part-time, mm-hmm. so 2.5 days a week. Mm-hmm. And then after spring break through the end of the year, they're placed in a new classroom for that secondary level of endorsement every day, full day, for the rest of the year.
And that's very similar to what I experienced as being a cooperative teacher.
Okay.
The other question that I had was, how many school districts, and this may be for your partner, how many school districts did you say you're interfacing with?
We're interfacing with 13 districts.
13
and
districts.
Those 13 districts train about, in the universities that we're working with, train about 58-60% of the teachers being trained in Oregon right now,
and
but 13 districts.
How are those 13 districts actually chosen?
They applied for the projects. The RFP went out 2 years ago, and they applied, and Chalkboard originally said they would fund three, and then through the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, it was determined that they would fund two of the other projects. So we have a project in Central Oregon and one out toward the coast, which they refer to themselves as the PAC, which are some of the mm-hmm. smaller districts, Woodburn, Tillamook, etc., who are part of that group funded through ODE. But Portland Metro, which is Portland Public, David Douglas, and North Clackamas are funded through Chalkboard. Salem-Keizer is funded through Chalkboard, and then Springfield is also funded through Chalkboard.
And so the actual amount of money, Madam Chair, that's coming out of the general fund for this program would be how much?
In terms of the ones that are funded through ODE, it's about $235,000 a project, so two projects right now for the base funding. This particular bill doesn't have any funding attached to it. This is a work group.
So, and this work group is just going to be staffed by the Department of Ed?
This work group is staffed by TSPC.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, too, either. What is the incentive to become a cooperating teacher?
Well, I think the incentive that we're seeing now is what Kelsey mentioned to you, and that is their growth. They're seeing growth as teacher leaders and getting the extra training that goes with the Teach Oregon model. And so they're feeling a lot more comfortable. And then also, like she mentioned, the benefit too is having that other adult in your classroom. And with the co-teach model, it isn't the sit and observe for 3, 4, 5 weeks. It's they come right in beside the teacher of record.
If I could have just one follow-up.
Sure.
Is there a goal to have a certain number? Forgive me if I missed this in testimony, but is there a goal for a certain number of cooperating teachers statewide?
For right now, we're at 370 in the Teach Oregon projects, and the goal is about 1,500 in the timeline in the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, you're welcome, Representative Wilson. Thank you for the questions.
Thank you. Representative Reardon.
And Mary, I may have missed this. I think you said the program's been underway for about 2 years, correct?
Yes, and we haven't had all of the projects on board, Representative Reardon, with the training and co-teaching. We actually, three of the projects did their co-teaching training just a year ago, February, because we needed to bring in the team from Minnesota to do that training of trainers. So two projects were up and running and had a lot of it going on. And the good news was a lot of our university partners had faculty that were already trained in the co-teach model.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that in about 5 or 6 years, we'll be able to look back and see how many teachers are still successfully working in their
children. Yes, and we're surveying and gathering that data right now with our evaluation partners, Echo Northwest, who are evaluating the project.
Because the number of dropout teachers is pretty large. I don't remember what the percentage is, but it's a lot of teachers don't make it beyond 5 years. Is that correct?
Well, I have to tell you that some of the data you see on that five-year projection is not as accurate, and part of that has to do with the way that we're collecting the data. So let me use Salem as an example because I know it best, and that was our retention rates looked pretty low in the first 5 years in Salem when you look at the data that's coming out of ODE. But what we have in the collective bargaining agreement is that after 30 days, you have to issue a new contract. And so consequently, what happens is a lot of our young teachers are having children. And you take a teacher out for longer than 30 days when they have a baby. And so consequently, that appears in the state system of data as an issuing of a new contract, which looks like a resignation. But in reality, many, I would say most, of those teachers are coming back into the classroom after they have children. So I hope that answered the question. So I would say be cautious of the data on the five-year retention information.
Well, and part of that, we're going to have to get going. Part of that on the five-year retention is that's also generational. There are the new generation of teachers, the new generation, whether they be a teacher, whether they be a software engineer, or whether they be something else, they don't stay in jobs. Mm-hmm. In a certain job,
yeah,
for us, for the entire career.
Right, there is a mobility factor.
Yes.
We are seeing a little less of that, which is good. And certainly there are some questions we need to ask about our system and our teachers. And I think thank you, Representative Doherty. That was a good comment.
McLean?
The only other one, Madam Chair, that I had to ask, and you are a lovely young lady. How many years have you been teaching?
This is my fifth year.
Fifth year. And you started this program last year?
Yes.
Okay. And that was the other issue, is I think it's real important to have, you know, teachers of all ages, you know, try to work through this program. And I really admire you for that, because they really do say that in the first 5 years of teaching, I mean, you're still learning, really still learning. And so it's a situation where to be able to take on two full-time jobs, that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? And I'm glad you are waiting. I had a student teacher when I was still a probationary teacher. So, yeah. Okay, thank you very much for
your
testimony.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Okay, those were the only two signed up for Senate Bill 83A. Anybody else like to speak on this topic?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, seeing none. I close a public hearing on Senate Bill 83A and open up a work session, a public hearing on Senate Bill 79A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 79A requires school districts to provide instruction in cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, and the use of automated external defibrillators, AEDs. It declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015.
Okay. We've got three panels. First, Sarah Higginbotham, Chief Mike Dyke, and Raul Meekums.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Higginbotham with the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association. I have a brief presentation here. I'm going to zip through it. You all already have it. My goal here is to both explain why we've introduced this bill and what we hope that the bill would accomplish. Sudden cardiac arrest. Over 400,000 people in the U.S. suffer every year. And I am going to move quickly, so again, fair warning. Less than 11% actually survive. We don't have a statewide statistic for Oregon's survival rate, though there are regional efforts happening. In areas like Portland, out of hospital, sudden cardiac arrest survival rates around 15%, just to give you an idea, but that varies all over the state. Bystander CPR, those first critical minutes after someone collapses from sudden cardiac arrest outside of the hospital, is their best chance at survival. Those first critical minutes are key. It's very important to note that when we're talking about CPR with regards to this bill, what we mean. In 2008, the American Heart Association updated its standards for CPR and its recommendations for CPR when it comes to normal folks like you and I who don't necessarily have to know CPR for our jobs, though some of you in your professional life did. And they introduced hands-only CPR, which is compression-only CPR, where you are not doing the mouth-to-mouth. It consists of two easy steps. To sum them up, one, you call 911, and two, you press hard and fast in the center of the chest. It's highly effective. That's the other reason the AHA decided to start promoting it, as did the EMS community. It can double to triple the chances of survival if someone sees someone collapse. Quick science lesson, if someone collapses in front of you from sudden cardiac arrest, they have enough oxygen running through their blood that if you can simply pump that blood to their brain, you're keeping them alive. Because the key with CPR, again, is to keep someone's brain from brain damage and keep them alive, not to get their heart restarted. With these new developments, we've seen 20 states, possibly more at this point, this is about a month old, pass legislation, CPR in schools legislation, to increase the number of survivors in their communities. With CPR being so simple to learn, we know that if more people in communities know it, the chances of protecting citizens is much higher. Senate Bill 79 would require school districts anytime between 7th and 12th grade to include CPR training for students in either, and forgive me because this presentation is out of date, we amended the bill to include PE or health class. CPR, a few quick notes that are important. CPR training does not have to result in certification. Teachers do not need to be fully certified in CPR to teach students. This bill would allow for volunteers to help train students. And CPR training must make students aware of what an AED is, not necessarily how to pull one out and use one. And the key part here is that, for example, in health class in Oregon that students have to take, they already have to hear about CPR, but they don't have to learn the psychomotor skill of getting down and doing it. And that's what we know makes people, enables people to have the confidence to step up in an emergency. A quick note on disparities, because it is so worth mentioning that, for example, Latinos and African Americans are at higher risk of suffering cardiac arrest, and in those communities, they are 30% less likely to receive bystander CPR. We know that school is a great equalizer, and that passing this bill would help every single community in Oregon. I'm going to skip forward to the end. And move backwards here very quickly. Resources and cost. Some schools around Oregon, I'm going to highlight a couple of communities, have been able to implement this already through partnerships with local EMS and fire departments. School districts have developed various models for providing and paying for the training and equipment. Costs can vary depending on those partnerships. And there isn't an exact formula, but the AHA estimates show that per student cost being approximately $1. For example, 10 CPR kits, there's a variety of manufacturers out there, with a training DVD and more, costs around $600. Those kits can train hundreds of students. It just depends how a school district wants to set it up. I'm going to move quickly through these examples because they're so worth mentioning and applauding. Eugene in Springfield is well on its way to training. It's already trained approximately 3,000 students since the program started in 2012. That's Eugene and Springfield Fire Department out training students in local high schools and middle schools. The Southern Oregon CPR Initiative is very impressive, and they are well on their way to training every single middle schooler already in CPR. They put together a community CPR committee, and Medford Fire and Rescue is collaborating with the school district. And they've trained approximately 1,200 students just in the last school year. Clackamas Fire District 1 has a program up and running, and their program is specifically worth noting, unique in that they train, and some of the other programs do this, but they train the students, then they send the students home with a kit, and those students then have a homework assignment of training 5 more friends or family members. So in total, they've trained since starting their program 11,000 citizens. And I'm not going to really touch on this too much because we have Fire Chief Dyke next to me who will talk about it, but there's a phenomenal effort that started in 2011 that's trained over 15,000 students in the communities of Beaverton, Wilsonville, Westland, Sherwood, Tualatin, and Tigard, and that is a collaboration between TVFNR, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and Legacy Health Systems, as well as the local schools. The EMS, it's no surprise, the EMS community has stepped up in support of this bill. There's a list of just some of the fire departments and EMS agencies that support the bill. I just wanted to lastly note that the AHA is also working actively to provide resources and support schools in their effort to teach students CPR, and provided 23 schools with the resources to do so in just the last year. With that, I will wrap up and pass it on to the rest of our panel. And once everyone comes up and speaks, I will be around for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Chief Dyke?
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Mike Dyke. I'm the fire chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm also the president of the Western Fire Chiefs Association and a part of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. I'm here today on behalf of TVFNR and Oregon Fire Chiefs to express our support of Senate Bill 79A with that amendment. TVFNR does serve 9 cities and 3 counties, population base of over 450,000 people. Our cardiac arrest survival rates do exceed the national average, and I attribute this to the fact that we've invested in paramedics and cardiac arrest, cardiac equipment, advanced life support, drugs. But more than that, we have a community that is willing to perform hands-only CPR during a cardiac arrest event. The fact is, too, our schools are making a huge difference. Since November of 2011, we've trained over 15,000 students in our district, and that's thanks to the partnerships of all those school districts. Mentioned Westland, Wilsonville, Tiger, Tualatin, Sherwood, and Beaverton. And Beaverton just happens to be one of the school districts that recently has just said, let's train all the middle school students in that specific class. So before the end of this month, we'll have 4,000 students trained in Beaverton School District alone. We did have a great partnership that started back in 2011, and that was with Valley Catholic Middle School in Beaverton. They were the first middle school in the state of Oregon to enter into a partnership with a local fire department, TVFNR. And there, every eighth grade student is trained how to do CPR, and similar to the Clackamas program, they were given a kit. Valley Catholic is a fairly small school, so 75 kids in the eighth grade class, and just in a few months, those 75 kids trained 1,000 members of the community, and they've done that every single year since we started that program, and have actually traveled around the state. You may have seen in the media lately, they were on the coast helping school districts learn CPR, training the kids, and passing that on, really minimizing the effect on the school districts with what we're talking about today. Just a couple months ago, Valley Catholic helped us train 700 people in Washington Square just on one afternoon. We know this is working because we've had students, Valley Catholic has reported students that have graduated have called back to the school and say, I remember my training, I had an incident happen, and I saved a life. They've moved on, obviously, all over the country and have reported back that they remembered the skill because they actually got down on their hands and knees and did the skill in school. So we know your mission will save lives by requiring all students to be trained in hands-only CPR before graduating will bring 50,000 trained lifesavers to the communities in Oregon every single year. We appreciate the work that you're doing in our communities. You're helping change attitudes and taking action when someone needs help, and you're empowering people to take the knowledge and the knowledge that they get from this training and do the right thing. So Oregon's Fire Service stands ready to assist you and our schools in this simple yet life-saving program, and I want to thank you, and I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hear from Mr. Meekums, then we'll open it up to questions.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and committee members. Thank you very much. My name is Raul Meekums. I live in Tualatin, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak regarding Senate Bill 79 today. On August 12th of 2012, I had a sudden cardiac arrest at my home, and I am one of the very lucky few who survived this event, and being within TVFNR is, I think, a huge factor in that, too. With the assistance of the 911 operator, my wife, Sandra, performed hands-only CPR and she hadn't had any CPR training since high school. Over the first 5.5 minutes, well, she performed the hands-only CPR on me for 5.5 minutes prior to the arrival of first responders. Mm-hmm. And she's just 5 foot tall. Mm-hmm. This was just the beginning of a chain of events that led to my survival and providing me the opportunity to speak with you today. The longest period of hands-only CPR was for 44 minutes. Mm. It was performed on me in the ICU. I credit my survival to my wife's initial CPR, which allowed my vital organs to be sustained, and the subsequent quick care by the Tualatin Police Department, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, Metro West Ambulance Service, and the excellent staff at Legacy Meridian Park Hospital. By training students in hands-only CPR, we are creating a potential life-saving group that may not only save the lives of family members, but may save fellow students and other victims of sudden cardiac arrest. When a CPR bystander is near, they can double, even triple these victim survival rates by giving victims the help they need until EMTs arrive. Requiring all students, Oregon students, to be trained in CPR before graduating will better equip our community members to help save a life and prevent disability in those first critical minutes before first responders arrive on the scene. And we have the tools that allow victims of sudden cardiac arrest a chance of survival, but none so numerous as that of our children. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. Are there any questions of this panel? I would like to also talk about, I had a town hall, and Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue came out and trained, well, maybe 25, 20, 30 people that came to the town hall. And it was, first of all, a very good training. I was trained in hands-only CPR, and it's one of these things that I would also have loved to have seen the kids there helping us out, because it's one of those things that once you learn, and it's better if you have more than one person to do it, because to do hands-only CPR for 5 minutes is a long time. So anyway, but it's a very, very good program, and I highly recommend it. Representative Reardon.
I'll just comment that I'm getting to the age where I really want to have a lot of trained people around.
Yes. You know, yes.
I'm not totally kidding, but yes. So I really encourage this, and I think one other thing that hasn't been mentioned is you're teaching kids to acquire a skill where they can be prepared to give back to others. And I just think that really helps build character in addition to possibly saving some lives. So, I don't know. It's just, I really think it's good work. So,
it's a great program.
Thank you.
Representative McLean.
I think I may have told one of you when you were in the office that my husband died in 2009, but he was brought back 7 times, and by myself and my daughter, who was only 16 at the time. And there is that feeling of helplessness until you learn something that you can do that can actually help. And to me, this is a program that has lots of meaning, probably from my own personal experience, but also because I agree with the representative that giving them a skill that can help others is something that can make them feel better in a very trying or a stressful situation. So,
thank you. We're glad you're here.
Me too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, the next panel we have is Joanne Hatch, Andrew Gable, and Julian Carmadelli.
Chair Doherty and committee members, my name is Joanne Hatch, and I'm with Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I'm the public education chief. I work on our educational outreach programs for the district, including hands-only CPR. Today, I wanted to share the story of one teacher that we partnered with from Fowler Middle School in Tigard. Here's what Allie had to say about her experience. For the last 2 years, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue has offered to train students at Fowler Middle School in hands-only CPR. Last year, they worked with the health teacher at Fowler Middle School, and this year, I was eager to provide the training to my PE students. We were able to complete this session in one class period. Firefighters from TVFNR led the training and provided the mannequins. While the students really enjoyed the visitors from the fire department, hands-only CPR training is simple and something that I could teach the students myself. As a middle school physical education teacher, it is a challenge to engage every student in every activity. There's always someone who doesn't like the unit or the activity we are working on, but it was different with the CPR training. Every student was eager to participate and found it compelling. Many middle school students struggle with work completion, but they were eager to complete this task. 90% of the students completed this assignment on time, and this is huge. When I asked kids what they liked about it, over and over again, they said and could be heard saying, "I could save a life." It is my opinion, middle school isn't just about academics. It's also about learning about yourself, your strengths, your weaknesses, your interests, and your values. That's what's important and what's important to them. One of the most important things that students can learn is how to be a helpful and concerned and active member of their community. Knowing how to perform the simple act of hands-only CPR to save a life is a perfect fit for curriculum in middle school health or PE classes. CPR training is something that every Oregon student should and can learn in school. I ask for your support with this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions after our students go.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hello, Chair Doherty and committee members. My name is Andrew Gable. I'm a Boy Scout, and I'm a certified professional lifeguard. As part of the Health Careers Program, I've had a chance to teach compression-only CPR. Marwa, a friend of mine at Beaverton High School, decided to do her senior project and teach 1,000 kids how to perform compression-only CPR. She invited me to help out with these teaching sessions. Over the course of 2 days and several sessions each day, we taught 1,000 kids how to perform compression-only CPR. At the start of each session, the kids were shown a short presentation, and then they had an opportunity to go out and practice with mannequins, CPR mannequins, practice the skills. While they were practicing, Health Careers volunteers like myself and firefighters walked around and watched these kids. We make sure they were doing things right, and we gave them some tips on how to do things better. The whole process for each session took 1 hour, and it was fun, easy, and quick. Ensuring that every student in Oregon learns CPR in school is important because CPR saves lives. When someone suffers a cardiac arrest and has CPR done immediately after that, their chances of survival are tripled. Last month, freshman Haley and Jasmine in a high school found a man unresponsive in a McDonald's parking lot. He was in his car, and he was surrounded by his friends who were splashing water and trying to wake this man up. Luckily, these girls had learned how to perform CPR a few months earlier in their high school health class. They pulled the man out of the car and started performing CPR right there in the McDonald's parking lot. After 5 minutes of CPR, the man gave a gasp for air. They had resuscitated this man and saved his life. A few minutes later, the emergency medical services arrived and stabilized the man. One of the police officers on the scene told the girls that without their CPR, this man would have died. Teaching CPR to our students and our community would save lives. Emergency medical services arrive really fast, within minutes, but those minutes are precious and defining. Students can effectively perform CPR while the emergency personnel are en route. I know if we teach CPR, there will be more life-saving and inspiring stories like Haley and Jasmine's. I'm prepared to save lives. Please support Senate Bill 79 so the rest of my classmates are prepared too. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and committee members. My name is Julian Commerdell, and I'm a student at Westland High School. As a volunteer alongside Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, I've had the opportunity to go to my former middle school, Athey Creek, and teach the 7th grade class the simple but extremely important basics of CPR. I've helped set up the teaching areas and have personally led groups of students through the process to help reinforce and teach the aforementioned basics. CPR is a very simple and easy to learn skill that unfortunately few people feel the need to learn. Teaching CPR is a very simple endeavor. The students I have had the pleasure of working with have been very attentive during the lessons and focused during the applied exercises. Ensuring that every student in Oregon learns CPR is important because CPR is a life-saving skill. If students in Oregon are trained in CPR, there is now a greater chance that a person experiencing cardiac arrest will have access to CPR and survive. The current national average for survival of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, as previously mentioned, was 10.4% according to the American Heart Association in 2014. CPR education is personally very important to me because my father had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he developed cardiac complications after chemotherapy. And in summer of 2012, he had a cardiac arrest at home. He was successfully resuscitated on the floor of our living room, and that prolonged his life by 2 years. As soon as my age permitted, I got fully certified in CPR. And in my freshman year of high school, I performed a research project for the Intel Science and Engineering Fair, which compared CPR certification rates between Oregon and Louisiana. It was at the fair that I was approached by Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue and introduced to the project, which I'm so honored to be a part of. Anyone can save a life, and everyone should know how. I hope you support Senate Bill 79 so that there are lifesavers in every community across Oregon. Thank you for your consideration and your public service.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of this panel? Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Chair Doherty.
Excuse me, Representative Bredo.
Maybe not this panel, but the previous panel, but I'm looking at the defibrillators and just wondering if this just includes instruction on using them or if this includes actually using them.
Well, why don't we, could you hold that question because
sure.
We've got one more panel and then we're going to bring Sarah back up and I think she can answer a lot of those technical questions.
Perfect.
Is that okay? Okay, and you'll remember to do that. Okay, any other questions? Thank you so much, and thank you for what you guys do. We appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the last panel we have is Kaylee Nelson, Joni Cosgrove, and Sarah, if you want to come up, just so you're up here for questions.
Yes. Sure. Chair Doherty and committee members, thank you for hearing all of us out. My name is Kaylee Nelson. I'm a recent graduate from the University of Oregon, and I'm currently a volunteer with the Eugene Springfield and Fire Act C3, which is right now training students in the Eugene Springfield area on CPR. The reason that I became involved in CPR and this life-saving skill is because in 2011, my sister had a seizure in front of me, and this was a very traumatic experience for me. At the time, she did not need CPR, but as some of you already know, it is a helpless feeling to watch someone that you love and not know what you can do. And that is why I got involved. That's why some of these other volunteers have gotten involved. And that shouldn't be how everyone gets involved. Not everyone should have to have a traumatic experience to want to learn how to save a life. You should have that knowledge and that training before that event happens. So I've been volunteering to teach other students, and I hope that everyone else will support this bill as well. This is an Oregon problem. The last time that it was studied, Oregon was ranked the fifth worst state for cardiac arrest survival. And hopefully this bill and training these students, 45,000 trained lifesavers every year in our community, will help that. And that's why I'm here to support SB 79.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, Joni Cosgrove here today for Legacy Health. I want to offer our enthusiastic support for Senate Bill 79A for all the reasons you've heard. In the interest of time, I'll be very brief. As Sarah mentioned in her presentation, Legacy offers the Middle School Healthy Hearts Program, and that teaches hands-only CPR as well as how to have a heart-healthy lifestyle to kids. We see this bill as a critical next step to expanding this important work. I want to thank the American Heart Association and the other proponents for bringing it forward and encourage your support.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any questions of all of them? Representative Bredo, we're going to answer your question.
Okay.
Yeah, so in the bill language, you'll see that it includes, it requires instruction in the uses, I believe.
Right.
The uses of automatic external defibrillator.
Right.
And then below that, when it gets to CPR, hands-on instruction. Mm-hmm. We've been using hands-only a lot to describe the actual act, but hands-on training is what we're looking for. That's the psychomotor skill that we want kids to get, so they're not just hearing about it, but they're actually doing it. So this bill would not require teachers or school districts to actually get kids hands-on with an AED. They do have trainer AEDs. I don't know if anyone's used one, but you can use them. They show you how it works. That would be great, but this bill does not do that. This bill just makes sure that students know where they are and know what they are so that perhaps they could send somebody running to get one while they're performing CPR.
Follow up?
Representative, yes.
If you had those on site and they were there, then who would be instructed to use them apart from the emergency medical teams that come in?
In an emergency, thank you, Representative Barreto, for the question. In an emergency situation?
Yes.
The training that we would, and I can also defer to TBFNR for the training they provide, but the protocol would be to call for help first, call 911, send someone to get an AED immediately, and begin CPR. And anyone could go and run and get an AED. AEDs are very, very, very user-friendly. Hopefully no one's had to use one, but I know Senator Chair Haas, who's a champion of this bill, has used one in this building. You open it up, and it tells you how to use it. It says step one, and it literally speaks to you.
Well, maybe as a follow-up on this, I know every school has a trained team of educators that in not only hands-only CPR, but the other kind of CPR. And so it's not, everyone is not trained in that, but you have the core of people in every building that has been trained on that. So.
And fully certified.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you all so very much. Great program. It's just a great thing, great town hall for everybody to have. Your fire departments will help out. Okay, those were the only ones we had signed up for Senate Bill 79A. Are there any further people? If not, I close the public hearing on House Bill 79A and open up a work session on House Bill, on Senate Bill. We'll do this here, Devlin.
Yeah, he's
good. Okay, a work session on Senate Bill 287.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 287 deletes the provision that authorizes teachers who are licensed and properly endorsed by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to practice speech-language pathology without obtaining a license from the State Board of Examiners for speech-language pathology and audiology. It becomes operative July 1, 2016. It creates a grandfather clause for the teachers who are already licensed and properly endorsed before July 1, 2016.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 287 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 287 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Senator Barreto?
Aye.
Representative Hatton?
Aye.
Representative
McClain? Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. And Representative Hack, would you carry this on the floor? Thank you very much. Okay, with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 287 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 588.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 588 allows school districts and public charter schools to be considered a single legal entity for the purposes of public charter school law. If the public charter school is the only school in district and other conditions are met, it declares an emergency effective July 1, 2015.
Okay.
Chair Doherty, I move Senate Bill 588 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Frederick moves Senate Bill 588 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, seeing none. Tia, could you call the roll, please?
Representative
Hatton? Aye.
Representative McClain?
Aye.
Representative Peluso?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Barreto?
Aye.
Vice Chair Frederick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Springer?
Aye.
Chair Doherty?
Aye. Okay, with that, the motion passes. Representative Barreto, could you carry this on the floor?
I would.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, I close a work session on Senate Bill 588 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill
135A. Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 135 directs the Department of Education to pay for costs of education of students in eligible day treatment programs and eligible residential treatment programs by making grants and aid to school districts where programs are located. It specifies exclusions to the costs of education. It declares an emergency July 1, 2015.
Okay. We're going to have Senator Devlin. Do we want to have Jan speak first? Or wait? Oh, we'll stand at ease just for a moment. You want to go before? If she's in the bathroom, don't go in there, okay? Thank you. Did I open up a work session?
Public hearing.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my apologies for being slightly delayed. I was in the middle of a question to the State Housing Director. that some of the people in the in the hearing probably wish I hadn't asked. I'm here today to speak about Senate Bill 135, which changes the way the Department of Education...
Yes, Senator, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Sorry.
We know you, but the voice doesn't.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to speak in favor of SB 135, which changes the way the Department of Education pays for the cost of educating students in eligible day treatment programs and eligible residential treatment programs. Long-term care and treatment programs provide services to those students with mental health or severe behavioral issues. The Task Force for School Funding recently reviewed long-term care and treatment programs during the 2014 interim, actually, I believe, over about a 16 or 18-month period. In 2011, the responsibility for educating children in long-term care and treatment facilities changed from the Oregon Department of Education to the school district in which the facility was located. Part of this, when this change was made, language on contracting, maintaining that funding for the facilities flow to districts through a contract, which causes logistical issues for the school district, the Oregon Department of Education, and the long-term care provider. If I might extemporaneous a little bit from my prepared testimony here, what it basically meant is the Department of Education spent a lot of time negotiating contracts, school districts spent a lot of time negotiating contracts with the ODE, the school district, spent time negotiating the contract with the provider of the actual services and the facility for the children that were in long-term care. And a lot of time and a lot of money was spent on contract negotiations and monitoring. And in some way, the focus wasn't necessarily always on the welfare of the children. Not that everyone wasn't trying to do that, but there was a lot of barriers put into this process that don't actually make a lot of sense in the long term. SB 135 clears up the gray area and changes the statute so that long-term care funding is provided to school districts through a grant and aid program. If anyone has any concerns about that, one of the things that's kind of interesting is through grant and aid, we can probably actually ensure that more of the services actually get to the children that actually need them than we can through actually contracting with so many different levels, so many different costs till we actually get to the point of delivering the service to the child. The bill itself has no money attached to it. However, the co-chairs of Ways and Means have allocated adequate funds within the co-chairs framework. Actually, we allocated some additional funds to ensure that the grant and aid funds are adequate to meet the educational needs of impacted children. Now, if I can go away from my prepared testimony, fundamentally what we have here is somewhere between 850 and 1,000 children. They're not always the same children. Some children are in these programs for a few weeks, a few months. Some are there long term. They are children that are just as deserving of educational opportunities as any other child in this state. We struggled with this in Ways and Means for really 2 years. Representative Comp and Senator Monroe spent weeks discussing this issue, trying to come to a resolution of it. I know the Department of Education has spent far more time trying to discuss a resolution to it. There are a lot of stakeholders in this particular issue. What we came to the conclusion is our focus should be on the needs of the children. And this is the best way that we came to ensure that those children actually have the services that they actually need and that best practices are followed in terms of providing those services. And actually, at this particular moment, and actually since this bill has been introduced, we have all the stakeholders on board.
We like that.
So with that, Madam Chair, I just urge your support.
Okay, thank you. Ms. McComb?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb with the Oregon Department of Education. I want to thank Senator Devlin for all the work and time he's put into this topic. We really appreciate it. As he has said that during last summer, when we were talking to the school funding task force, this topic came up. And we started looking closely at the statute. And the statute, the existing law, says that we shall contract with the school districts. And we think that language was inadvertently left in when the law was changed in 2011. It used to be that we, did have responsibility for the education, and we contracted with these districts. But in 2011, it changed to the school district in which the facility is located. But that contracting language never changed. And so I think a grant in aid really makes sense, and will make the law consistent. It's a little bit of a good government bill, because we think that by making the changes in Senate Bill 135, the department's going to benefit, because we can eliminate all those costly, time-consuming DOJ-reviewed contracts. Mm-hmm. The school district is going to benefit, because they're going to get the money up front instead of using their general fund to pay these facilities and then get reimbursed by the department later. And also, instead of sending us invoices, you know, which can be lengthy and time-consuming, they'll just be able to send us a summary of their expenditures. That should save them some time. So hopefully this will save everybody a little bit of time, and again, free up time for us so we can do more technical assistance for the districts and ESDs and facilities when they call. I'm happy to take questions.
And Madam Chair, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that Representative Springer was on the task force.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Any questions? Okay, the one question I have, because I know when they switched over, so example, if it's something like Christie School, which is a residential thing that is in West Lynn School District, does this preclude them from, for the West Lynn School District to subcontract to like Clackamas ESD or?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, no, it doesn't. They can still subcontract. Okay. And in fact, the bill was amended on the Senate side to make it a little bit easier. If the school district wants the department to send the money directly to the ESD or school district, they have to let us know, and we'll do that.
Okay. And to make it very clear, it is only for the educational program as opposed to the facility itself.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, the other two we have signed up is Doug Riggs and Janet Ahrens.
Thank you very much. My name is Janet Ahrens. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. We're a statewide nonprofit that takes care of other nonprofits that take care of kids. We represent about $223 million in services through 45 member agencies, and that's over 100,000 children. 57% of all the long-term care and treatment programs that Senator Devlin was discussing are represented in the alliance, so we're very, very invested in this bill, and happy that you're hearing it today. So as they described, while this bill doesn't solve all the issues, which Representative Springer knows because she's been a colleague working on this for a few sessions as well, the grant and aid is a really good step, clarifies a lot of issues, gets more money going to the provider of the services, and gets more kids educated and more dollars dedicated towards that. And it has a couple of clarifications in it also, which makes it much, much easier when school districts are confused about what to do. Sometimes you see a default position of they're not going to do it until you can prove to them otherwise. And so it's really helpful to have it be so clear for everybody and everybody on the same page. I wanted to talk to you just momentarily about our kids who are receiving these services. There have been as many as over 1,100 children receiving these services. 43% of those are children of color. 94% of them come from homes that require that they get free and reduced lunches. 99% of these kids come from enough poverty-struck families that they're all receiving the treatment portion of the services through Medicaid eligibility. So this is a very, very important population of kids, and as we know from ACE studies and other trauma studies, that education is critical to their ability to be able to move on and finish high school and achieve the goals that we hope for them. The original Christie list you were mentioning, Chair, Doherty about the Christie List, was actually formed through legislation 37 years ago. And there have not been very many changes since then. And we hope someday that to have even a little more reform on the Christie List, get rid of the list, and have any eligible child be able to attend any eligible service area to receive these educational services in partnership with all of the districts. But for right now, this is a great move. We're very, very pleased. It's been a long journey and a lot of work. A study that was done in 2008 from the American Institutes for Research raised concerns about how the funding got to school districts and got to providers and cited that it was not a rational formula, that the weighting they used for the children was arbitrary, and that there wasn't the quality and services and funding for children in day treatment versus those in residential care. So this is going to help us get closer, and we're appreciative of your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Riggs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Alliance and Children's Programs, and I'll be fairly brief. I want to emphasize a couple things. First of all, to hit on a point that Janet just made, this is the seventh or eighth session that we've been working on this issue, and there was a report that was mandated by this body back in 2008 that produced a report, 2006, I believe, produced a report that came out in 2008. We've had bills and budget notes in 2009, 2011, and 2013, and we greatly appreciate the support of the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, Representative Springer and Senator Rod Monroe and Betty Kopp have been fantastic on this, and Senator Devlin has been terrific, so we really appreciate them. Sometimes it takes a lot of people to move even small programs forward, and I also want to acknowledge the great work of Mitch Kupka and Sam Coe and Jan McComb of the Oregon Department of Education. Immediately when they came on about a year and a half ago, they recognized that this was a problem, and that was something we had not heard from the department for a long time. You know, this is a small number of kids every year. It's a different group of kids, so the total number of kids in the program is more than 800 or more than 1,100, but slots is 800 or so. But it's a really important subset of kids. I mean, this is the tip of the spear of kids who need supports, intervention, family supports. They need an education because these are the kids who do not attend school, become the chronically absent when they go back to school, and do not graduate. As many of you know, we had a big conference on chronic absenteeism in the fall, and we will not get to the chronic absenteeism solution, and we won't get to the graduation solution unless we find ways to reach out and serve this 6 to 8 to 10% of total kids, and this is a subset of those kids. So we believe that this is a small but very important step. These kids are like any other kid in the school system. They're like my kids, they're like your kids and grandkids. You know, they deserve an education from the state, and this bill gets us a significant step down that road. So we really appreciate that today. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, those are the only ones we had signed up for Senate Bill 135. Anybody else? Okay, with that, I close a public hearing on Senate Bill 135A. And we have completed our business for this Friday. Thank you all very much for coming. I really appreciate it.
Oh, somebody's waving at you there.
Yes, Representative Springer.
Madam Chair, are we going to be hearing this bill next week in a work session?
When we look at our agenda.
I certainly don't want to hold the gavel up, so I can get an answer offline on that.
Yeah, okay, we can do that, because I know we're not working any when you're gone, so anyway. Okay, anything else? Just to make you feel good, we did just send out an agenda for no meeting next Friday, the 15th. So, anyway, okay, with that.
There is none next Friday, is that what you said?
Except you have to come. Yeah. No meeting next Friday the 15th.
Frederick had some.
No, I was just waving. Yeah, thank you.
I'll wave.
With that, I close the committee on House Education.
That's been known.
House Education.